When you're 16 years old and you're coming out, this was part of what the article is about. Politically, they don't see much for them. And then also culturally, gay culture consists mostly of adult things.
Malcolm, who just died, my agent, was also my lover. So I can't in good conscience take this money from you.
It's just this chain of grief from, you know, rage and heartbreak to vengeance.
I want to tell a good story. I want it to be a rip-roaring good story.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Equality advances in Britain, but there's a split decision in the States. It takes time to talk to queer teens and a Tinseltown story of lust, corruption, and revenge. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the weekend in November 12, 2005. Signs reading "No Gays" will follow those saying "No Blacks and No Irish" into Britain's dustbin of history if the government's newly amended Equality Bill passes through Parliament. The bill approved this week in the House of Lords would outlaw sexual orientation-based discrimination in providing goods and services or organizing public functions. Originally, those protections were only to be offered to religious minorities, but over 100 members of Parliament signed a motion to press a reluctant Blair government to add gays and lesbians to the covered groups. Gay peers Lord Waheed Ali and Lord Chris Smith and the lobby group Stonewall led the charge, warning that the whole equality bill might fail if the Prime Minister did not accept the amendment. The new law would include a broad range of services, from National Health Service care and insurance to hotels, restaurants, and stores. Stonewall activists are cautiously optimistic about the bill's chances when it goes to the House of Commons in a couple of weeks.
The ballot question in the U.S. state of Maine read, "Do you want to reject the new law that would protect people from discrimination in employment, housing, education, public accommodations, and credit based on their sexual orientation?" Voters there answered with a resounding no on Election Day, November 8th, defeating the third effort by religious conservative groups to prevent a state non-discrimination law from going into effect. Pro-bias groups were successful in repealing similar laws in 1998 and 2000. In March, the state legislature passed and the governor signed another bill protecting gays and lesbians from discrimination. The Christian Civic League of Maine and the Maine Grassroots Coalition led the repeal effort this year. But the third time was the right's charm, as voters, by a margin of about 55% to 45%, reaffirmed the basic values that are intrinsic in Maine, said Governor John Baldacci, who strongly opposed the repeal effort. "Mainers don't like discrimination. If it happens to one person, it happens to all of us," he said. This year's law also protects transgendered people from discrimination. The new law's opponents charged that it was the first step toward marriage rights for same-gender couples, but the legislation was specifically worded to say that it did not address that issue. The repeal backers' written materials claimed the non-discrimination law meant that a pedophile cannot be barred from a job as a public school teacher. Broadcast ads urged voters to repeal the law to keep it from forever changing the innocence of our children and to protect your right to protect your children. Executive Director Matt Foreman of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force called the campaign tactics disgusting, reprehensible, and immoral. Maine becomes the 17th U.S. state to ban discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and the 7th to protect transgenders.
However, not unexpectedly, Texas voters, by a margin of about 3-1, overwhelmingly approved a state constitutional amendment banning any legal recognition of same-gender couples, defining marriage exclusively as a union of one man and one woman. Lauding the efforts of 30,000 activists across the Lone Star State who fought against the measure, Human Rights Campaign President Joe Solomony said, "This fight for fairness isn't over and we won't give up." Texas becomes the 19th state to add an anti-queer marriage amendment to its constitution. Equality opponents are gearing up to place initiatives on several other state midterm slates a year from now.
While no queer-related issues were on the California state ballot, petitions to put a marriage equality ban before voters there are also being circulated, however. four propositions supported by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger dealing with legislative redistricting, spending cuts, teacher tenure, and limiting political activism by labor unions were soundly defeated. Schwarzenegger had vigorously campaigned for all of them up and down the state. Following his veto of a marriage equality bill earlier this year, Equality California, a leading queer advocacy group in the state, worked in coalition with other opponents of the propositions, distributing more than 200,000 mailers featuring a photo of Schwarzenegger on the cover with the headline, "It's Payback Time." Said the group's executive director, Jeffrey Kors, "Our goal was not only to defeat each of the governor's measures, but to defeat the strategy of dividing people to win elections. We hope these results send a powerful message that the politics of division is unwelcome in the Golden State."
Historic firsts for lesbi-gay candidates included the election of the first openly queer officials to the Cleveland and Columbus, Ohio city councils, as well as the first openly gay city council member in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Gay men or lesbians were also elected to city councils in Lakewood, Ohio, in the Seattle, Washington suburb of Des Moines, in Palm Springs, California, Minneapolis, Minnesota, New York City, and to the town council in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The Gay and Lesbian Victory Fund, which works to elect qualified GLBT candidates, announced that of its 55 endorsed candidates this year, 35 won their races or performed well enough to proceed to a runoff. There are now slightly over 300 openly gay or lesbian elected officials in the United States. About half are city council and county commission members, according to the Victory Fund.
Queer rights activists also cheered the defeat of Virginia State Republican delegate Richard Black, described by the Human Rights Campaign as one of the most anti-gay legislators in America. He co-authored Virginia's Marriage Affirmation Act, which bans same-gender marriages, civil unions, and some fear even private contracts entered into by queer couples. He was defeated by a Democrat who supports civil unions. Black had also fought to ban adoptions by gays and lesbians, proposing legislation that would have required social workers to determine the sexual orientation of prospective parents. But perhaps the sweetest local electoral victory for equality supporters in the U.S. came in Cleveland Heights, Ohio, where City Council member the Reverend Jimmy Hicks Jr., who had earlier campaigned against the country's first voter-approved domestic partner registry there, lost his bid for re-election to Mark Tumeo, an openly gay man.
It may be hard to say whether the U.S. Supreme Court's decision this week not to hear the appeal of a transsexual's successful job discrimination lawsuit indicates anything about how new Chief Justice John Roberts may handle LGBT-related cases, but it is nearly certain that a new associate justice will not be confirmed by the time another such case reaches the court. Roberts came to the court late in the process that ended with the justices letting stand a federal appeals court finding that Cincinnati, Ohio police officer Felicia Barnes was illegally discriminated against when she was demoted during her transition. Barnes' lawsuit cited a 1989 Supreme Court decision on sexual stereotyping in the workplace, one in which retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor wrote a separate opinion offering guidelines to help lower courts determine whether an employer had used illegitimate criterion such as sexual stereotyping as a substantial factor in a personnel decision. With an important case involving a challenge to the Pentagon's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy set to be heard by the High Court in early December, concerned activists are breathing a sigh of relief that swing voter O'Connor will apparently be around for a while. Beleaguered President George W. Bush's second shot at a nominee to fill O'Connor's seat, conservative federal appeals court Judge Samuel Alito, is now scheduled to begin his confirmation hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee on January 9th.
Alito has already received rave reviews from the Republican Party's religious right constituency that panned the previous nominee, presidential attorney Harriet Myers. He also has a 15-year track record on the bench for Democratic senators to pore through. LGBT legal advocates are also carefully studying Alito's past writings and rulings. One opinion in 2000 struck down a school district's anti-harassment policy found to be in conflict with Christian students' free speech right to criticize homosexuality. Then in 2004, Alito's appeals panel overturned a lower court's decision that a student bullied for being effeminate should be required to continue on to high school with his longtime harassers. Still, Alito's positions on a woman's right to choose, affirmative action, and privacy issues are troubling to many.
And finally, after years of increasing visibility and acceptance of queer content on U.S. television, Brazil was all set for its big moment. On November 4th, a huge TV audience, reportedly larger than the one for the last World Cup soccer final, watched an evening soap opera in anticipation of that country's first televised gay kiss. The final episode of America, broadcast by media giant Globo, got enormous attention for the promise of a smooch between the show's heartthrob Junior, played by Bruno Gagliasso, and hired hand Zeca, played by Aram Cordeiro. "The director and I made the scene. It was recorded," America screenwriter Gloria Perez told reporters. "The two actors claimed they performed the kiss with great gusto, and people from all sectors of society were eagerly anticipating the steamy lip lock. Alas, it was not to be. The kiss never made it to the air. In the final cut of the episode, Globo's management chose to broadcast a version it thought most appropriate for an 8 p.m. showing of a soap opera," the network said in a statement this week. "The kiss that didn't happen sparked a passionate protest as hundreds of gays and lesbians staged a kiss-in in front of Brazil's congressional building. Several waved rainbow flags, and one protester yelled, 'Let's show this country how gays can kiss.' Most of the demonstrators were somewhat quieter, of course. After all, they couldn't yell because they were too busy kissing."
And that's News Wrap for the week ending November 12, 2005. Written this week by John Beaupre, Lucia Chappell, and Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Greg Gordon. Preview an unpredictable postmodern Hollywood morality tale later in the program.
Extra, extra, read all about it, extra.
In a Time magazine cover story in mid-October called The Battle Over Gay Teens, John Cloud explored what coming out is like for queer kids at the beginning of the 21st century. He reached some opinionated conclusions about the next generation and how adult GLBT communities are or are not caring for them. This Way Out correspondent Kathy Sanchez caught up with John Cloud recently to discuss some of his discoveries.
The article was very in-depth and obviously took some time to conduct the interviews and gather the information. What got you started on this issue? What interested you about the coming out process for gay youth?
I was a gay kid, and in 1997, right after I got the Time, I suggested a similar article, and in fact did a similar article, although much smaller. At that time, it was interesting to me that there were 100 gay straight alliances, and now 2,900 additional GSAs have been formed. Now, some of those have folded. Last year, something like 3 GSAs were formed per day during the school year. So it's certainly spread from the coasts to the entire country, which was the other interesting thing, having grown up myself in Arkansas, you know, where you think you're the only person alive.
You mentioned in the article that teens weren't helped during the coming out stages by the LGBT community as a whole for many years. In your interview with the teens, what did they say about that?
Well, what they say is that they still don't necessarily sense that, you know, gay culture really has much for them. And I think there's two levels for that. There's the political level, which for these kids, the gay politics as it's conducted in Washington by the Human Rights Campaign, in New York by Lambda Legal, is more or less irrelevant to them. I mean, they're not ready to get married. You know, most of them are joining the military. This sort of marquee symbol that the Human Rights Campaign has been trying for so long to get, which is, you know, non-discrimination, federal non-discrimination legislation, doesn't really matter if you're 16 and you don't have a job. So I would say politically, they don't see much for them. And then also culturally, gay culture was formed and is formed and consists mostly of adult things. I mean, we share a sexual interest. And so that becomes a rather adult culture. And when you're 16 years old and you're coming out and you go online, you can find things. And in fact, this was part of what the article is about. You find more and more things that are targeted for youth, like the website younggayamerica.com, which is a really great website, or outproud.org, which is more of a resource website. But there's a lot of also, you know, gay porn and internet and chats and that are inappropriate for kids. And I mean, think about it. If you're 15 years old, whether you're straight or you're gay, you know, the characters on Will and Grace don't make sense to you necessarily. I mean,
right.
Their lives look rather foreign to you, and so that's, you know, no different if you're a, you know, gay or a bi or a trans kid.
Looking at it from the other perspective, in talking to the Gay and Lesbian Straight Education Network, or GLSEN, and other gay organizations, did they offer any explanation as to why, if coming out is easier for teens, there is still a good deal of harassment and violence in schools?
Well, to answer the first part, I mean, I think it's easier for kids to come out now because culturally it's much more accepted. I mean, you know, one of the biggest shows in the country is Desperate Housewives. One of the sons of one of the housewives was seen in a pool last season with another boy. They're in high school. He came out to his parents. His sexuality is somewhat uncertain, you know, but he's at the very least bisexual. And by the way, that is a very common, that's actually quite accurate for such a silly show. It's quite accurate for the lives of a lot of gay kids now. They don't necessarily claim a gay identity. They don't like gay politics. They don't necessarily believe that gay culture reflects their lives. So they say they're polysexual or they're, you know, just attracted to the person.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in terms of schools, there are kids who come out in the traditional way and they are bashed and made fun of. And, and there is a greater risk of suicide for gay teens than there is for straight teens or for all teens.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that research is a little bit older, but all of the research has indicated there is a greater risk for suicide.
You did a lot of spending time with a lot of youth. You did, you know, days at camp with both Exodus and also with GLSEN and GSAs. Overall, after all of the interviews, after all of the research, what did you walk away with?
I guess I walked away with, you know, a fair amount of surprise. And I tried to convey this in the article about how young people are, you know, the extent to which people are coming out. And by that, I don't just mean claiming a gay identity. There is a sort of, and this is what some of these activists are fighting over, there's this kind of tenuous ground where kids, they don't really come out, but they say, oh, you know, I really am in love with my best friend. I mean, a girl will say that she's really in love with her best friend, and she has strong romantic attractions for her best friend, and she'll tell her other friends that, and that she, you know, maybe wants to kiss her best friend. So she clearly has some same-sex attractions. Is this girl a lesbian? Well, not really in any way that we would think of it. I mean, maybe she's 15, and maybe she's never had sex, and maybe there have been some love letters exchanged, or maybe there's been a kiss. But that sort of adolescent process of kind of working all this out and the fact that that has become so much more public and that kids are so much more willing to talk about it, that really surprised me. I mean, to find a kid like the boy who's on our cover,
mm-hmm.
who came out under the circumstances that he did and really has had, you know, not much trouble related to that. I mean, I guess that was the most surprising thing. And I, just to emphasize, I met Corey, who's on our cover, at an Exodus conference. He went to, Exodus is this Christian ministry for people who don't want to be gay. He went there not because he doesn't want to be gay, but because he wanted to investigate that side of the argument. I found that really remarkable and actually really optimistic, sort of really wonderful. I mean, I think that's a very bright way of going about it. Instead of screaming at each other, you know, we can sort of listen to each other.
That was John Cloud, the author of the mid-October Time magazine cover story about queer youth, in conversation with our Kathy Sanchez. You can find the entire article online at a number of websites. This Way Out listener Dr. Robert Simmons Jr. of Dayton, Ohio, in honor of his mother Mabel Simmons, has issued a donor matching challenge to supporters of this program. To continue doubling our pleasure, Dr. Simmons has extended the deadline to November 30th, 2005. Please visit our website, thiswayout.org, for holiday gift-giving ideas, a year-end tax break, and to see how your help to keep This Way Out on the air will still mean twice as much to us. We'd be very thankful. It's unique postmodern Hollywood noir, unsettling, unpredictable, and morally explosive. That's how This Way Out's Steve Pride describes the directorial debut of a familiar out screenwriter.
The Dying Gaul is a psychological thriller based on the Craig Lucas play of the same name. Part Sunset Boulevard, part Greek tragedy, it's a tale of lust, power, corruption, betrayal, and revenge. Robert, played by Peter Sarsgaard, is a screenwriter who's written a film based on his lover's death from AIDS. studio executive Jeffrey, played by Campbell Scott, loves the script but has a theory.
Most Americans hate gay people. They hear it's about gay people, they won't go.
What about Philadelphia?
Philadelphia is a movie about a man who hates gay people.
So Jeffrey asked Robert to make one little change.
If we make Maurice a woman with AIDS, and let's face it, heterosexuals are getting AIDS.
I want nothing to do with that.
Robert.
But what will Robert do when Jeffrey offers $1 million for a revised script?
You have virtually no idea what $1 million would mean to me in my life. I'm still paying off my college loans. I've written 15 spec scripts, which no one will buy. I'm paying child support. And Malcolm, who just died, my agent, was also my lover. So I can't in good conscience take this money from you.
Eventually, Robert does take the deal. He also becomes close friends with Jeffrey's wife, Elaine. And in a surprising turn, he begins an affair with Jeffrey that has tragic consequences. While this is the directorial debut for out gay playwright and screenwriter Craig Lucas, he's not new to Hollywood, having written Longtime Companion, Prelude to a Kiss, and The Secret Lives of Dentist. But in all his dealings with the movie biz, Lucas never had to make the Faustian bargain he presents in The Dying Gaul.
I have to say that most of the movie is invented. I know the world a little bit. I worked out here a little bit. Not very much. Nobody ever asked me to de-gay a script. And certainly no ostensibly straight producer ever came on to me. Most of the producers that approached me about projects out here were already gay and they were out. So, you know, you make up a story, but for a story to work, there have to be problems. Some of the things that Malcolm endures are things that I've seen happen to people with AIDS, but he's not based on an agent that I knew. You take what you know and then you transform it in some way, hopefully. You imagine new elements and desires and you add them to the mix and then hopefully it takes on a life of its own.
The journey the audience takes hinges on performances of the three leads. Campbell Scott starred in two earlier Craig Lucas films, Longtime Companion and The Secret Lives of Dentists.
We just get along. We see each other's sensibilities and ourselves, I guess. Campbell likes a certain amount of complexity in the role, and he likes to be surprised. We had a great time on Longtime Companion. We were both just starting out in movies then, 15 years ago, and he makes me laugh more than anybody on earth, and I love his acting. He does always half of what you think needs to be done to get it across. As a result, there's an artfulness to it that if you really know acting, if you've really worked with actors and you understand what's required, is high-wire stuff. He's an actor's actor. You will find here in Hollywood and in New York that when you say his name, people basically genuflect.
Campbell Scott's real-life girlfriend, actress Patricia Clarkson, astonishes as Jeffrey's wife, but she doesn't believe it's Jeffrey's bisexuality that propels Elaine to visit revenge upon Peter.
I think they have had dalliances, both of them, and been accepting of it. But I think what makes this different is it's not the affair itself. It's her feelings being deceived by two, not one. It is the double deception because she is smitten with Robert. Robert is a kindred spirit. I mean, I think she kind of falls in love with Robert. Maybe not so much in a sexual way. I think she finds him just an absolutely beautiful man, inside and out. He's kind of a window into her past again, and I think he sparks her, and it gets her so excited and so interested, and it all comes crashing down around her, you know? It's just this chain of grief from, you know, rage and heartbreak to vengeance, and I don't know that it's that small, you know, that it's that big a leap. I think they are very small steps.
And what does Craig Lucas want the audience to take away from The Dying Gaul?
That's a hard question because I don't come at storytelling in that way. I don't think about that. I want to tell a good story. I want it to be a rip-roaring good story. I want to turn them upside down and shake them. Anything that isn't attached should fall to the floor. I want to juggle their brains and their and send them home astonished and surprised and happy to be alive. That's what I think really wonderful theater and movies and novels do. They make us very grateful for what we have. And if they're profoundly great, they also lead us to an inevitable choice of how we need to behave in our lives.
In the film, Robert's screenplay is also called The Dying Gaul. And in case you're wondering,
the title is a reference to a sculpture that's in the Capitoline Museum in Rome. It was made by a Roman sculptor of the vanquished Gallic enemy soldier who was killed in battle. He's got a little hole in his side, but he's in all other regards healthy. And it's kind of a startling thing to see, because when you first walk into the room, unless you know what you're going to see, it seems to just be a very beautiful young man. And then to realize that he's staring at the ground because he knows he's going to be dead in a few minutes, it kind of takes your breath away.
I couldn't leave Patricia Clarkson's hotel room without asking her why she thought her best roles, those in High Art, Far From Heaven, and now The Dying Gaul, came to her from gay writer-directors.
I don't know. It's a great question. Provocative. I'm not sure. I think there can be a gay perspective, because I do think a person's sexuality is important. I think it is important. And, you know, these people like, I don't care what people do in the bedroom, it's so fun. No, what you do in the bedroom, you know, your sexuality is integral. It's very important. It defines you. It's who you are. It's hopefully what you're proud of and what you can be open about. So I think our sexuality is present in us at all times, in everything we do, in our daily life. And so, yeah, there might be a gay sensibility. But I would think of it more as a gay perspective, because I think our sexuality plays a large part in how we view situations and how we view the world.
This has been a conversation with actress Patricia Clarkson and writer-director Craig Lucas. The Dying Gaul is from Strand Releasing. For more info on this and other queer films, visit prideonscreen.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, John Beaupre, Lucia Chappelle, Graham Underhill, Rex Walkner, Kathy Sanchez, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Thanks also to Rita Gonzalez. You heard music from the Dying Gaul soundtrack, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen online to This Way Out exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, www.thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Your help to keep this program on the air will still mean twice as much to us. Please log on to thiswayout.org to find out how. To sign up for our weekly emailed program information messages and or our monthly This Way Out updates, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WDFH, Ossining, New York, KSOW, Cottage Grove, Oregon, 2HOT, Cobar, New South Wales, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody stay tuned.